America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Your secret behaviors and desires somehow find their way onto your Google searches, and once collected and compiled, alongside others, no names please, social scientists and data doctors can tell us a whole lot more about what's happening in our society than you can ever imagine. And certainly more than by asking us those questions directly. Because guess what? We lie. Often, in order to look better or give the answer we think the interviewer wants. But with the massive storage of data, questions that before you made by your gut can now be rigorously considered. Even things like, should I marry this person or that? And where should I live? In data we trust. That's today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Seth Stevens Davidowitz, and he's written a book called Don't Trust Your Gut, Using Data to Get What You Really Want in Life. Now, you come to us as a data scientist, a Google, Harvard-trained. I mean, you've got some remarkable credentials, Seth. And you also had that incredible book in 2017 called Everybody Lies. Do you want to tell us the lineage from Everybody Lies to Don't Trust Your Gut?
Yeah, so I wrote this book, Everybody Lies, and it was about how you can learn about people from their Google searches, so all these kind of secret behaviors that people kind of don't necessarily talk about, and I had all these sections on kind of hidden problems in society, child abuse and do-it-yourself abortions and inequality and a lot of these topics, and I wrote the book, and it got a decent amount of attention, and I asked people, you know, afterwards, you know, what really resonated with you about the book, you know, Everybody Lies, and everyone was saying that it was sections on, you know, the world's problems, the child abuse I mentioned, do-it-yourself abortion, things like that, how can we fix inequality. And then I looked, Amazon Kindle, actually, you can see what sentences people underlined. And I noticed that people are underlining anything like how you can help yourself, like what should you say on a date, how should you raise your kids, how can you lose weight. All those sections seem to get more interest. And then there was a study, a big data study, that came out and said that the sentences with the word you are 12 times more likely to appear in the most underlined sentences in Amazon Kindle. So anytime you mention you, people really like it in books. So I kind of like, okay, well, if that's what people are really interested, secretly interested, even though they're maybe lying to me and saying they care about the world's problems, I'll just pander to them in a way and just write an entire book on self-help and how you can improve your life. So Don't Trust Your Gut just is 9 chapters on what big data can tell you about the biggest issues you may face, whether it's, you know, whom you should marry, how you should date, how you should parent, how to pick a career, how to be happier, kind of big topics in life. And I think, you know, another motivation for this book is that there's just so much data out there now that these questions, I think, you know, I am frustrated. I read an embarrassing amount of self-help, or maybe I shouldn't be embarrassed because everybody apparently does as well. So I read a ton of self-help, and I'm always a little frustrated. As a data scientist, they kind of read as wishy, you know, as not based on very much, in my opinion, where you just, you know, like, even the studies they quote, they're old, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they asked 20 people some question and kind of justified some grand theory based on this tiny sample. And, you know, I know from my experience as a data scientist, my time working at Google, my PhD program, you said there, you know, whatever the credentials are, that actually now is the time where we can answer these big questions much more rigorously using all the data available in our new digital age. So I spent, you know, a few years just kind of reading people about all these biggest kind of data studies on the biggest like questions.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, because years ago on a radio program that I did, I interviewed a gentleman who wrote a book called SHAM, the Self-Help Actualization Movement. And yeah. He was saying that there's a lot of things that you can debunk about, and we see it on the internet, as you know, even though the internet is a great fount for all kinds of information, as you point out. But I just was Googling through on something, and I saw the 5 ways to happiness. And I doubt that they match what it was that was in your book in any way. But I want to say this, that you are really clever, and you have a reveal in the book. You start off wanting to make certain that people want to read this book, because your first sentence, "You can make better life decisions. Big data can help you. We are living through a quiet revolution in our understanding of the most important areas of human life, thanks to the internet and data." So right away, you were there to capture us. And I've got to tell you, you did a good job doing that. However, let me just ask you this. Most people still, to this day, who haven't read this book, and I would think that is a majority of Americans, though maybe not, of course, we'd hope, that they still make most decisions using their guts. I mean, isn't that true?
Yeah, I think that definitely is true. And it's problematic that I think the way most of us make decisions, we might talk to a couple random people, we might read some not very good studies or some sham self-help book, and then we kind of just do what feels right on even the biggest, most important fundamental decisions that we face. I would say that that's the approach that just about everybody takes to life, with very few exceptions.
So what are the breadcrumbs that we're leaving on the road to greater understanding through Wikipedia profiles, Facebook answers to things that we like? How much information are we leaving for people like you to pick up and others and try to, help us to better understand some of these large questions in our life?
There are all kinds of new insights. So, you know, I talk about, for example, dating sites, and that's kind of, when you think about how we study dating, how we study how people pick mates prior to the existence of Tinder and Hinge and OkCupid and all the other big data sites, big data dating sites, it wasn't based on very much. We kind of just asked people, "Hey, what do you look for in a mate?" And people said, "I want someone who's nice." And that was kind of like, okay, here's the paper. People say they want someone who's nice. And now it's like, well, what do people actually want in a partner? And I think the interesting thing about that is that people are incredibly predictable in what they're looking for in a partner and what they look for on dating sites, what makes people click, what might make people swipe right, doesn't correspond at all with what makes people happy in a long-term relationship, which is other, you know, studies that people have, that we're learning a lot more in our new big data age. So people, when they're on an online dating site, are much more likely to, you know, go after someone who's conventionally attractive. Women are really into men who are extremely tall. Women are drawn to men of certain occupations. The most attractive occupation online dating site is a lawyer. I didn't know this. People are drawn to people who are very similar to themselves, even on some seemingly silly dimension. People are 11.3% more likely to match with someone who shares their initials in an online dating site. Like, who knew that this is something that draws people to each other? And yet, as predictable as we are on these, also some disturbing things, race plays a big role. People are much less likely to respond to African-American women, Asian men, kind of an unpleasant reality revealed in the data. But then if you look at, okay, what happens, let's track a whole bunch of couples and use the most advanced machine learning on what makes people happy in romantic relationships, the things that tend to predict romantic happiness aren't the things that people are drawn to an online dating site. There tend to be psychological traits. Someone who's conscientious, has a growth mindset, has satisfied with life, who has a secure attachment style, these things that psychologists have discovered, various measures of psychological health, and the things that people are trying to date, ferociously competing on in online dating sites, conventional attractiveness, height, occupation, sharing one's initials, all these things don't correlate at all with how happy people are in a long-term relationship. So it kind of shows, I think, the limitations of our gut-driven approach to life, where if you just swipe on the most exciting person you see, you're probably it's not necessarily a great path to romantic happiness.
Yeah, and for many of us, I mean, we never went on online dating sites. I've been married for 44 years, so
yeah.
Obviously I didn't really have that whole pool available. I stuck with a local gal, and it's all worked out. But let me ask you this. If 40% of the couples are really meeting online, that goes back to 2017 data that you had in the book, what does that portend going forward? If, in fact, many of these superficial traits are what we made our decision on, I mean, I know we've had this issue of divorce over the years in America, but, I mean, is it suggesting perhaps that it'll be even greater going forward because we looked at the wrong things?
I think it's cliche to just criticize, technological changes, and I don't want to be that guy who's just always like, yeah, everything new sucks. But I think there definitely are dangers with online, and there were certainly limitations with the traditional approach to dating. And it's been hard for some people who have, more eccentric tastes to find people who fit those, their tastes exactly. It's become a little bit easier with online dating. But I do think there is a concern. And I was talking to a researcher, Paul Eastwick, who's done a lot of research in this area. And he said kind of the ideal dating pool, maybe something like college dorm, where you spend a lot of time with a lot of people who are all kind of single, but it's not so quick. There have been studies that a lot of people find someone they're not initially attracted to, if they like them over 1 month, 2 months, 6 months, 4 years of college, they start finding them attractive. And then they're more likely to kind of overrule these gut-driven, shiny traits that we're all drawn to. Which probably online dating does encourage more of that approach, not a slow build up where you really see if you have a connection with someone.
Well, I liked that study that you talked about in the book, and that was people at the beginning of a class, let's say, and they judged who was the most attractive in the class. And that was based, again, just on conventional look. But over time, as they got to know their personality, their sense of humor, their intelligence, that changed over the course of that class. So I think that was really emblematic of what you were just talking about. Seth does a great job, by the way, in the book, of telling us why our gut is not a reliable guide. You start off by saying we are often too optimistic. Secondly, we latch on to information we want to believe. And third, we wrongly conclude that we can explain events that were unpredictable. And so we have a lot of cognitive biases.
Exactly. And that's kind of the biggest development in social science in the last 20 to 30 years has been discovering all these cognitive biases. And Danny Kahneman's research, so the book Thinking Fast and Slow, has popularized a lot of these flaws that we have as human beings. And I think one of the things that I'm trying to do in Don't Trust Your Gut is say, okay, well, we're flawed as human beings, but what do you do with that information? So you can read, let's say, Danny Kahneman's book, and millions of people have read it, and it's kind of depressing. You're just like, oh, we're hopelessly flawed as human beings. We have all these biases. But there's not necessarily a takeaway. Okay, well, what do you do? And I think one of the things you can do to overcome these biases is learn from the data and learn from every, when you're trying to pick a mate, learn from 11,000 other couples and which ones that ended up happy, and try to, in some ways, copy what they do. And so I think big data offers, in many ways, a solution to our faulty gut, a way for us to make decisions that isn't as hopelessly biased as our mind tends to be.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz is with us. Don't Trust Your Gut. Now, a lot of people have studied the area of happiness, And I remember I for a PBS station, and we were involved in a production with a Harvard professor who had the most popular course on campus, and that was happiness, Tal Ben-Shahar. And now you're studying this so rigorously. I know Yale has had another course that was very popular there. Now, in studying happiness, the whole idea of having money, why don't you break it down for us?
Yeah. So that happiness was another area where I started reading a lot of the studies, even the famous studies that got a lot of attention. And a lot of them where they, you know, interviewed 100 people, you know, a couple dozen people and asked them some questions. There are all kinds of problems with this approach. I kind of became obsessed. There's team Susan Morado and George McCarron, and they've created this app, Mappiness, where they ping people on their phones. It's really using our digital age, where they ping people on their phones, and they say, what are you doing? Kind of what are you doing? Who are you with? And how happy are you? 0 to 100. And there are other groups that have done this. There's Matthew Killingsworth at Virginia, and there's Happy Air at Netherlands. There are a whole bunch of teams it's called experience sampling. And they build these enormous data sets that are 1 million people, 3 million people. So Matthew Killingsworth, for example, has done a much larger study than anybody has ever done on the connection between income and happiness. Kind of one of the number one questions when I said I'm going to write about happiness, people are like, well, you know, does money make people happy? And now we know pretty precisely how much money matters. And the answer is it matters, but it really doesn't matter very much. So The more money you have, the happier you are. But you have to double your income to get an increase in happiness, to get that the same happiness boost. So going from $40,000 to $80,000 gives you the same happiness boost as going from $400,000 to $800,000, or going from $4 million to $8 million. So to get happier, you kind of have to – you're on a treadmill of sorts where it's getting faster and faster, and you have to earn more and more money to get the same boost. And the thing that was really striking in these big data studies of happiness was that the things that make people happy are almost like shockingly simple. Being in nature, there's increasing evidence that nature really, really does boost people's mood when they're, and particularly being by water, by a lake. That's kind of the world's happy place, according to these studies. And being with friends is so important. If people report that they're with friends or a romantic partner, they get just an enormous boost in happiness. Certain activities.
Seth, I mean, let's be honest. You talked about sex being one of the things.
The number one happiest activity, which, I think hopefully isn't too big a surprise to everybody. Maybe a sanity check that these methods are picking up the right stuff.
But going to a concert or going to the theater.
Gardening, and one thing we did is we actually, I was, so Mappiness, the study from, the study was with Alex Bryson and George McCarron. They kind of rated 40 activities on how active they are. And then with my friend Spencer Greenberg, we're like, okay, they have this rating based on what people are saying they're doing, how happy they are. We're going to just ask people to guess, kind of, based on your gut, how happy do different activities make people? And then you find that there are certain activities that people systematically overrate, and they tend to be passive activities. So when people are lying down, watching TV, even reading, I hate to say it as someone who's an author.
No, I know.
People to read, that was painful for me, but I had to present the data. When people are kind of doing nothing, they tend to report they're not that happy, and much less happy than people tend to suspect they would be. So I think that one of the lessons I took from that and kind of I've adopted in my life is there's this feeling that I have, that probably you have, that just about everyone can relate to, where you've been invited to something, you know, your friends want to go on a hike or go to a show, and you're just tired. You're like, I just want to lie down and watch Netflix or read a book or surf the internet or go on social media. I really don't want to do it. And I think it's really important. Your gut's telling you not to do it, and I think it's really important to overrule your gut in those situations frequently. And kind of, even if it makes you go, oh, that's a lot of energy, your future self's going to thank you, because once you get started, you're going to be maybe surprised by how happy you are doing that activity.
Yeah, you tell us to get off the couch and don't listen to Larry David and what he tells you about that. Now, I've got to ask you, I know, I don't think we're a terribly happy society. In fact, I just did a podcast asking the question, is America having a nervous breakdown with somebody who's in that field? But let me ask you about things that make people sad and really despondent. Has there been much study? Because one of the things I'd love to use these data sets to do is to help us be more predictive about somebody who might want to do some self-harm or take their own life. Is that a possibility using this data?
Yeah, so I've done some research on this other researchers. So Google searches is a great resource for this, because some people, when they're in real trouble, they turn to search engines and they say, I'm suicidal, want to commit suicide, how to commit suicide, really sad, dark searches. And I've actually been doing my own research on this. I talk about a little bit in Don't Trust Your Gut in other places as well, where I think it's interesting to learn what people search for before they make a search for suicide, to really get inside the mindset. There's one thing I found a bunch of people in one of these data sets. This is again anonymous data, that before they search for suicide, it's young teenagers, they searched that they were just diagnosed with herpes, the STD. Mm-hmm. And you know, we don't usually think that a diagnosis of herpes is a cause for suicide. And if you ask people in a survey, what's the cause for your suicidal ideation, I'm not sure that a lot of people admit that. There's a lot of shame around those types of things. But you do see in the search data, people making those searches. And the other thing I found in that data was the number one search that someone makes when they search herpes and suicide. The other search is celebrities with herpes. They're basically looking out for heroes who also have this condition that they've been diagnosed with, that they're so embarrassed of that they're thinking of committing suicide. And actually, I was looking at the time when I was doing this research, what happens when you search celebrities with herpes. And at the time, it was a bunch of celebrities accused of having herpes who denied they had herpes. And I'm like, that's what a horrible message to greet a suicidal teenager who's just been diagnosed with this illness, and due to the shame around, STDs, is thinking of harming themselves. How many lives would we save if celebrities lowered that shame instead of denying that they have this, say, I have this and I live a fine life and you can have a fine life as well. So things like that, really interesting data. And then sometimes the other thing is just, I talk about, in Don't Trust Your Gut, I include a couple anonymous search strings from an AOL data set that was released a while ago to researchers. Wind of the human mind from big data is sometimes, sad, really sad and shocking, but also profound, where you see someone who's in horrible back pain and they're just going back and forth between searching about back pain and suicide. I think you might remember that string, and it's just heart-wrenching. And it kind of does, I say the only self-help from that is just be kind to people, because you never know what they're going through. And someone may have, may seem like they have their life together, and then they're lashing out at you or something. You're like, why is this person so mean? And then if you saw their searches, you'd be like, oh, that person's in agonizing pain all day, and can't seem to find a treatment for that. And, so I think sometimes the data does reveal the secret suffering that many of us experience without openly talking about.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you point out, both in Everybody Lies and in this book, that people are really honest with the search engine, and they're not afraid. Now, we used to tell our hairdresser everything. Now, I guess we tell Google searches. You say the most important data set ever collected on the human psyche is a Google search. Now, I was kind of surprised, and we don't really have to get into it, and I'll let people read the book, but of what men often are searching about in terms of their own body part. I mean, really, that was kind of shocking to me, I've got to tell you. But you said that a lot of this started, let's go back to baseball. You love baseball. I love baseball. You're a Mets fan, right?
Yeah, I'm a long-suffering Mets fan.
Well, I'm a long-suffering Knicks fan, but I'm also a San Francisco Giant fan, the original Mets. And so I'm not as long-suffering as you are. But Bill James and data, sabermetrics, when you relied on your gut, decisions were dead wrong, and you talk about this all being money ball for your life.
That's exactly right. It was another motivation for my book, in addition to the fact that people underline sentences that have the word you in them, was being a big baseball fan, one of the major lessons of baseball of the last 20 to 30 years is the power of data analytics, that the way baseball clubs ran their teams in the 20th century, relying heavily on their gut, their intuition, what scouts said, what they thought they saw. Phil James and other cybernetricians were like, well, no, all these things you're doing aren't justified in the data. And it's just been revolutionized baseball. And it occurred to me that the way we make decisions in our personal life, you know, whether what we decide whether to go out on a given night, you know, as I talked about, whether we go for that hike with friends or lie down and watch Netflix, what career we pick or dating, who we pick in a partner, we're kind of in the pre-Moneyball era of that. And I think, you know, when you say it, just about everybody has to agree that the way we make these decisions is not, who are we more like? Are we like the baseball teams pre-Moneyball who talked to a couple scouts, said, what do you think about that person? And then said, yeah, we'll take that player. Or are we like the post-Moneyball teams that looked at the best computer analytics and data analysis and regression studies and said, well, actually, that's a great player. Even though he or she might not look like one, should we bunt or should we not bunt? You know, the pre-Moneyball was like, oh, I don't know, bunt, that could work. Let's try it. Maybe talk, the manager will talk to his assistant managers and say, yeah, let's try bunting, and then you bunt. And then the post-Moneyball is, no, we actually are going to do rigorous quantitative analysis of whether to bunt or not, and frequently we were bunting way more than we should have been bunting. And so I tried to bring that approach to these big decisions in our personal life. You know, the book, Don't Trust Your Gut, is kind of just filled with charts and figures.
It's really fascinating, I got to say. And it's really interesting because it's not only in baseball, of course. I mean, I did a podcast about the Golden State Warriors and what made them so great. And yeah, the analytics that they would use, the way the cameras were set up around their arena to measure everything, even including things like lift. You know, when you have an older ball player who's a great three-point shooter like J.J. Redick, but you think, oh, he's too slow now. But if he can still get up, you know, within a certain point and hit his arc for his shot, he's still as necessary as he was early in his career. So there are so many things that these analytics folks are looking at that you and I, as the average fan, don't see.
And sometimes you find things where, like, how did it take us this long? I talk about that they've done studies where tracking every shot, that most NBA jump shooters are twice as likely to miss a shot too short as opposed to too long. And it's like, how did it take us that long to realize that there was just this very simple bias in NBA jump shooters' decision-making, that they should just put a little more on their shots and they'll make a higher percentage of them? It's really amazing how
well you also point out about where they are or where they miss the shots in relation to the backboard.
Yeah, they're more likely to miss to the side away from the backboard because hitting the backboard is kind of so embarrassing that they just way overcompensate and shoot away from the backboard. It's amazing the extent to which, you know, when you look at a data set, you find these biases. And I think it does make you kind of question, okay, NBA players have been practicing shooting since they were little kids, and they have these biases. And, you know, well, we haven't been practicing dating or we haven't been practicing parenting for nearly as long. Aren't we going to have big biases as well? And I think the data reveals, yes, we do.
Well, I do want to get into one more, and I'll allow people, really, they should get the book and keep it as a reference. I think it really is fascinating. But the one that really struck me was about parenting, as you just mentioned, and that being that it does take a village, no matter how good you are, no matter how much you try to stimulate your child, much of it is about where you live. Now, we know location, 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 but the way you broke it down by cities and then by neighborhoods was quite fascinating to me. Was that revealing you too?
Yeah, so this is work of Opportunity Insights, and they've studied tax records for tens of millions of children, where they grew up and how they turned out. They did really clever things. They looked at siblings to see when one sibling grew up in one place and another sibling grew up in another place because parents moved at some time, which one turned out better. And they found that you could really zoom in that a massive impact was the metro area you lived in, but also the city you lived in and even the census block that you live in. They correlated this with other facts about the area. So why are some areas so much better at raising kids? And one, the biggest predictors frequently were things about the adults in that neighborhood. Even some things, one of the biggest predictors was what percent of adults return their census form.
Yeah.
Kind of say that's the last thing anybody would have guessed based on your gut of what makes a good neighborhood, but that's kind of suggesting that upstanding citizens in the neighborhood is really helpful in many ways. And they've done more studies where they found that little girls, if they grow up in a neighborhood with adult female scientists, they're much more likely to become scientists themselves. African-American boys who are struggling a lot in contemporary America, if they grow up in a neighborhood with black fathers around, you know, forget their own father, they could be with raised by a single mother, but if their flock has a lot of African-American fathers, they have much better outcomes. So it seems like the adults we're exposing kids to beyond one's parents have a bigger impact than certainly I would have guessed. As you said, it does seem to take a village to raise a child.
Yeah, and you say lighten up on yourself, because I know a lot of parents work so hard to stimulate their children. But you say maybe where you live is equally important. Now, let me ask you, because that's an important one, a very important one. I mean, how much does somebody need to look at that? I mean, you talk about Seattle, Washington, Minneapolis, and neighborhoods within those areas, Salt Lake City. I mean, somebody reading this book, do you imagine that they might say, gee, maybe I'll move there? Or you know, should you look for something in your own area that is somewhat comparable?
I think some people will, you know, you never know. Some people read a book and they make, a big decision. Let's say someone was literally indifferent between moving to Seattle and Los Angeles. They have two opportunities and they have young kids, and they look at the data and they see, okay, Seattle seems to be way better than Los Angeles for raising kids. Maybe they'll nudge themselves to Seattle, but obviously a lot goes into where you live, not just you know, how much your kid's income is going to rise from living that place. But I think the spirit of the results anybody can use who are you exposing your kids to? And if you're looking for a particular block to raise your kids on, what are the other people on this block like? Are they the people you'd want your kids to emulate? Are there adult female scientists that might encourage your daughter to be an inventor herself? Or are there a lot of two-parent homes that would encourage your kids to get married and have a family? I think thinking maybe a little more about the company you're exposing your children to than you otherwise would is most certainly justified in the data.
Yeah, that's a great point. In closing, what do you think's the future? I mean, we look at trends, and how important is this data going forward, and in terms of the ways that it can be used to affect a better quality of life overall for individuals and society? What do you think?
I think it's going to be, I'm a biased person. Whenever you ask someone about their field, they always say it's huge and really important. Nobody's like, yeah, my field's not important. So obviously I'm going to be biased in the direction of saying data science is, you know, the right way to make decisions. I do think we're going to look back at how little information went into some of our biggest decisions and be shocked. And, you know, I don't know if it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, but there's going to be a time where, you know, the fact that people would just swipe on it right on dating apps without any knowledge of what made for a good mate and did these very, obviously incorrect things, like give an extra positive weight to the fact that someone shares your initials, that's going to be prehistoric in a short period of time, because there is just so much data accumulating on what actually matters. for these big decisions?
Well, I don't want to give anything away in the book, but I love the conclusion. The data-driven answer to life is as follows. Be yeah. with your love on an 80-degree and sunny day overlooking a beautiful body of water having sex. Well, that sums it up for me, and I'm sold. But I'll tell you, it's a great book. Seth Stevens Davidowitz, Don't Trust Your Gut, Using Data to Get What You Really Want in Life. And I thank you so much. It was a pleasure, really, getting to know you and getting to know the data that you have accumulated and the ways that we can use it more effectively. Thank you so much, Seth.
Thanks so much, Larry.